Shrink Wrap Radio number 537, Deliberate Practice for Psychotherapists with Dr. Tony Rumenier.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Tony Rumenier about his forthcoming book, Deliberate Practice for Psychotherapists, A Guide to Improving Clinical Effectiveness. For more information about Dr. Tony Rumenier, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Once again, today's episode is sponsored by SwellBee.com, a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to manage and market their practice, free and easy to use. Sign up today at SwellBee.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Tony Rumenier, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. Thank you for having me. It's quite an honor to be on your show.
Well, I feel very honored to have you here, and I'm under the impression that you've actually listened to the show over the years.
Yeah, it's a very special experience for me to be on the show, because when I was going through graduate school, I listened to your show a lot. This was back 2006, 7, 8.
Wow.
And since then as well, a number of my favorite supervisors and teachers have been on your show as well. John Fredrickson, Alan Abbas, more recently, Patricia Coughlin. So I'm a big fan of your show.
Yeah, I discovered that as well as I started reading your book. And it was like, oh my, how synchronistic in a way, yeah. Because I had just recently interviewed Patricia Coughlin. And I'm doing another interview with John Fredrickson, you know, before I even knew what we were going to be doing. He's got a new book out, and that's interviews coming up in a few weeks.
That's really cool. He is one of my favorites. I've learned so much from him. And yeah, he's featured prominently in my book as well.
Yeah. So I feel so honored to be one of the people, evidently, who's at least had some impact on who you have become as a professional psychologist, because I am so impressed by your book.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. You know, as I write about, there's a period in my training, though I started as a, you know, kind of a diehard psychodynamic therapist. At some point, I realized a lot of other models have just as much to offer. And I was looking for ways to learn about other models. And your show was a very valuable resource, because you're so wonderfully open to just learning from all the different models.
Yeah, great.
That really helped.
Yeah, that was my intent, was to give people kind of a broad canvas of what's out there, not just about psychotherapy, but psychology in general. So you've written a very provocative book in some ways, titled Deliberate Practice for Psychotherapists, A Guide to Improving Clinical Effectiveness. And just in a sentence or two, because we're gonna delve into this topic in greater depth, but just to get listeners on board to what we're talking about, because at first I was, deliberate practice, what's that? You know, I hadn't heard it in the context of psychotherapy. So in just a sentence or so, what do you mean by deliberate practice?
So deliberate practice is a term created by Kay Anders Erickson and other researchers in the science of expertise, and it refers to deliberate methods of training that people use across a broad range of fields to achieve competence, professional level performance, and then expertise.
Okay, great. You managed to condense your whole book into a couple of sentences there.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you come to write this book?
So since I started training, I have been on a quest to become a better therapist. I started out thinking that actually I was, frankly, pretty good. I have gotten humble with time. I didn't start that way. I was quite confident at first. And in my first practicum, I actually had a number of clients that responded very quickly to therapy. The research calls them fast responders. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've done therapy myself. I know what's going on here. This is going to be relatively easy. And then I quickly found that actually quite a few of my clients didn't improve. And over time, when I started kind of looking at it big picture, it looked like about half of my clients were not improving. I called them my other 50%.
Yeah. And it turns out the literature reported that that's kind of generally true. So it wasn't just you that were somehow failing them.
Yeah, at the time I didn't know that. So at the time I was quite embarrassed about this. And I talked about it in supervision with my supervisors, but I was like, there's something wrong with me. But yeah, it turns out that kind of across the field, roughly 50% of our clients don't respond well to treatment.
Yeah. And so is that how you got interested in the topic, or is there more behind that?
So as I realized that I really needed more effective methods of training and supervision, I looked around. And first, I started looking at different models. So like I said, I started...
Schools of therapy.
Yeah, models, the schools of therapy. Uh-huh. I started with a very strong adherence to long-term psychodynamic therapy because that's what I had done myself. And as I saw that it didn't help all of my clients, I eventually said, well, why don't I try other models? And so I, you know, was trying CBT, I was trying EMDR, I was trying all these different methods. And, you know, they're all great methods. They're all very effective with about half of my clients. I just couldn't break through the 50% mark. And also the not helping 50%, when you break down the 50% wasn't helping, there are a number of the clients that were just plateaued. There are at least half of those, 25%, were dropping out of treatment. And then some of them, maybe 5 to 10%, were actually deteriorating, getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Getting therapy. Worse. Yeah, that's not something that... I don't know that I've ever read another book or even an article in which a therapist has stated that their clients were getting worse. And so I have to congratulate you on... I loved reading your book because... it was so personal. You put in your personal story, warts and all, as we just heard potentially, and you take us through your process, all the while integrating everything that the literature has to say about the kind of quest that you're on. So I just think you showed tremendous courage and integrity, and really set an example for all of the rest of us out there.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So when I realized that 5, 10% of my clients were deteriorating, I was shocked. I was mortified. But as I learned more about psychotherapy outcome research, I found that that's actually an average deterioration rate. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I talked in the book a lot about my own personal challenges in training as a therapist is because I think my challenges are quite universal. You know, we all have more dropouts than we want. We all have more deteriorations than we want. We all have more kind of non-responders, people who we have a good working relationship. We, you know, meet every week and it seems to be going well, but over time, the clients just aren't really improving. We're not very good at talking about that as a field. And I'm hoping that we can do that more. Not just to get better, but to also help all of us just feel more okay about our limits, you know?
Yeah, good point. And your voice is actually joining that of others. It emerges like Scott D. Miller, who is another person I interviewed, but also got to see him present. And you noted what a great presenter he was. I was blown away. I thought it was the best presentation I'd ever seen. So he's quite a fellow. And he was advocating after each
treatment?
Yeah, after each therapy session, giving the client a little questionnaire to get feedback about how you're doing. So that was an important part of what you began to practice as well.
Yeah. So, you know, very originally when I heard about that from him, I was skeptical, and partly because I was doing this long-term psychodynamic model, and we're like, oh, everything works in the unconscious. So if a client is consciously filling out a form, you know, is it going to help, or could it even impair the process somehow? And honestly, there's nothing like seeing that you have a 50% non-response rate to make you open to trying new methods. Uh-huh. So I did try the tools that Scott Miller talks about. I found them to be very, very useful. And one of the cool things about collecting the outcome data from the client session by session is after doing it for a year or two, you have enough data where you can start looking at your whole practice. So not just how is each client doing, but by pulling all the data together, aggregating it, how am I doing as a therapist? And I found that I was doing okay. I wasn't bad. I was definitely at a level of competence that they talk about. In fact, I think most therapists are at a level of competence. When you look at the outcome data of most therapists and just routine regular practice, we have outcomes that are actually comparable to most randomized clinical trials, just like evidence-based treatments. We already do that well.
Okay.
Yeah. So, however, that still meant that level of competence meant that about 50% of my clients weren't getting better. And so that's what really provided the impetus to find how can I be a better therapist? And that's how I ended up finding deliberate practice. I was interviewing Scott Miller for Victor Yalom's website, psychotherapy.net.
Yes.
And in that interview, this is back in 2008 or 2007, like that. In that interview, Scott Miller mentioned deliberate practice. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, well, these are methods of training that professionals use in all these other fields, like sports or music or piloting or chess, but we don't use in psychotherapy. And so why don't we use them?
And so he was just putting that out sort of as a hypothetical at that point. It wasn't that he was doing it already or not.
Well, he was proposing that we look into it, and he was starting to research it himself at that point.
Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I wanted to ask you is this a movement? And if so, who's the pioneer? Maybe you're the pioneer. I don't know.
No, Scott Miller is definitely the pioneer. He was the first psychologist to really look into this research and consider using deliberate practice for psychotherapy. Since then, there have been a number of other well-known psychologists that have been writing about it. So Bruce Wampold has written about it. Rodney Goodyear has written about it. A few others. And we actually have an edited volume coming out with Scott Miller in a few months on this topic. But it's still at a very preliminary stage. There's researchers studying it, theorists writing about it. There's clinicians like myself kind of experimenting with it. But I would think of it like when they just started to develop methods of deliberate practice for music or sports hundreds of years ago. That's where we're at.
Yeah, that was striking. In the book, you talk about that and how it's been hundreds of years that music has been working on this. And I thought it was really genius to look into those other fields. And maybe we'll get into that just a little bit more in a moment. But I want to back up for a moment because some listeners / viewers might be a little confused by the fact that we're saying, well, we haven't explicitly said it, but there's a lot of evidence out there that psychotherapy in general is effective.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we're saying it's only 50% effective.
Yeah.
So maybe clear that up.
Yeah.
Possible confusion about 50% that.
50% response rate is actually really good. I mean, that compares favorably to many medical treatments. It 80% would be a lot better. 100% would be ideal.
Right.
But considering the challenges that we help people with, I'd say 50% is actually pretty good. I mean, we help people with long-standing depression, anxiety, trauma, addictions. Often they're interwoven. So, you know, we can have clients that show up with all four of those, for example, is not rare. And so it's almost like, imagine if you showed up at your family physician with like a broken leg, cancer, and diabetes all at the same time. Mm. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what we help people with. So we're doing very challenging work, and we're doing it without the benefit of basic science. So we don't have the equivalent of germ theory for psychotherapy. We have very few basic instruments that we can use. So considering all that, I think we should feel really good about the job we do. That said, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, somehow you are really remarkably driven to raise your average and really devoted yourself to it. So tell us a bit about that journey of how you began to move in that direction and what happened.
Yeah, so a lot of my motivation from that comes from my own therapy I did. As a teenager, I was in therapy that was very, very helpful. It helped me graduate from high school, kind of get my life on track. However, then later in my life, when I had recurrence of symptoms, anxiety, depression, and then also got involved in drugs, the therapy that I used was not very helpful. And I spent a number of years just basically spinning my wheels. Hmm. I had a good relationship with my therapist. He was trying really hard. I was trying really hard, and we just weren't getting anywhere. And so I know what that feels like to be a client in therapy that that isn't really getting better. And I've had a number of clients, you know, in my own practice that despite us having a good alliance, despite us trying really hard together, they just don't get better. And I, like most therapists, you know, we get into this field for good reasons because we want to help people, right? Yeah, we don't get in this field to get like rich or anything like that, right? And so it's very personal for many of us. And so that's what really drives me every day. How can I get better? Now, I
imagine there's some early therapists or students who maybe drop out feeling like, geez, I'm just, you know, doesn't seem like everybody's having the wonderful experience that I dreamed that they would when I entered the field.
Yeah. So, there were definitely times when I got demoralized as well. What I would tell students or therapists who start to get demoralized, I would say, don't kind of blame yourself. Instead, look at your training methods. So very, very few therapists have actually ever engaged in deliberate practice. And to clarify, deliberate practice does not mean seeing clients. Seeing clients is considered work performance.
Okay.
Right? Deliberate practice is something you do separately when there isn't a live person in front of you. If there's a live person in front of you, you can't repeat the same skills again and again. You can't isolate certain skills. You can't get feedback immediately from an expert, that kind of thing. All right?
Right.
Now, maybe I should start by defining what deliberate practice is. Should we do that first?
Yeah.
It goes into a lot more detail in the book, but to keep it kind of tight right here, deliberate practice is when you're getting feedback from an expert who's observing your actual work performance, so live or by video. They identify certain skills just beyond your ability, discrete skills. They teach you how to rehearse those skills, how to practice those skills, and then you repeat it many, many times, and then you measure the results. So, for example, have you ever learned a musical instrument?
Yeah, a guitar, and I worked late in life trying to pick up piano, but didn't get very far.
So, did you have a coach for either of those instruments?
No, I got a few lessons here and there. I don't know if I would call it a coach. The piano, actually, I took lessons for several years from different teachers.
Okay. Yeah. So imagine you went to your piano teacher and you said, so I want to be a professional level pianist, but I don't really have time to practice. I'm just too busy. Can you give me some books so I can read about piano theory and I'll just kind of memorize it, maybe write a few papers about it, and then I just want to perform.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
they would just say, no, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you ever play sports?
Yeah, in high school. I played football, ran track.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. So imagine you went to your coach, either track or football coach, and you said, look, I want to compete on the team. I just don't have time to practice. I got too much academics. Yeah. So, can you give me some books so I can learn about the sport? And I'll write a few papers about it or something, and then I'll just show up and I'll be really good. Right? Imagine what they would have said.
Right.
Yeah. So in both music and athletics, and many other fields, the bulk of the training and learning goes on in what's called solitary deliberate practice, when the person who's training has exercises that have been assigned by the coach or the teacher, and they're running them through drills again and again. Right. So for basketball, it could be shooting free throws from the 3-point line. Right. A player might do 100 a day. Or for a musician, I might be doing chords, might do a few hours a day of various drills. Right.
Yeah. And you point out that if there's a difficult passage in a piece, they will just focus on that passage and do it over and over and over and over again until it's totally automatic.
Exactly. So what's happening is the skills are moving into what we call procedural memory.
Mm-hmm.
So your brain can do them automatically. And that then frees your mind up to be able to focus on the more complex parts of the performance, right? Or the sport.
Right.
Now, what I found was that I was getting supervision. I was very fortunate. Throughout my training, I had really, really good supervisors. I know that's not always the case. But every practicum, all my internships, I had supervisors that are very... they're smart, they're insightful, they're very open, they're very collaborative, and they would give me really good advice. And the advice made sense. It's just that when I was sitting with a real client in front of me, I couldn't do it. I couldn't follow through with it, or I'd try one thing and the client would respond in a way that I, wasn't expecting. And honestly, what I realized later was my own anxiety was high enough that I had trouble performing the skill.
Yeah. Oh, one thing that's really important that I thought was extremely important that you just kind of passed over quickly is video feedback, because in most situations the supervisor is not going to be able to do direct observation.
Yeah,
and so we have this powerful tool of video, and you point out that it's just so much more effective to have your supervisor responding to what they're seeing on video rather than you recalling. And you talk about how faulty our memory is and maybe how selective it is when we report. That's what I came up with when I met with my supervisor. I would tell him the story of the session.
Yeah, this is just the way our brains are built, is to very selectively remember things. And then when we report it, it gets kind of, fudged as well. Even if we're trying as hard as we can to report. Now, I noticed this most. I was doing supervision with John Fredrickson, and he only does supervision with people who show videos of their work, right? So the same with Patricia Coughlin and Alan Abbas. And there were cases I would show him where if you read the transcript of the case, it would have looked like really good therapy.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
But what we saw in the video, for example, is in one case, the client was sitting way back in their chair. They spoke with a very soft voice. There was a lot of hesitation. While in the video, I was very forward and speaking with like a strong voice and sometimes even talking over the client. And by watching the video, John was able to notice, wow, it looks like the nature of your relationship is that you're kind of, I was in a one up and the client was down here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of teaching and they were learning and just kind of pretending to comply. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it could read like good therapy from the transcript, but the video revealed there were a number of mistakes I was making. And then what John was able to do is identify those key skills. And then I went home and practiced them. For example,
and you might role play them with him before you went home to practice.
Yeah, so we'd role play with him, right? So, for example, we pointed out, Tony, you're cutting off the client, And it wouldn't look like it in the transcript because the client spoke very slowly with long pauses. Mm-hmm. So it almost seemed like they were done talking and I'd jump in. But what that did is it basically made me the actor in therapy, right? It meant the drive was coming from me and not the client. And so what John did, we role played. John said, I'm going to role play the client and I'm going to speak very slowly. And as I pause, I want you to notice your own anxiety if it goes up and if you feel the urge to jump in and say something. And I noticed it. And I ended up writing down on a post-it. I keep a little post-it on my desk. I wrote down, don't interrupt. And I put it behind the client on the wall. So where the client's chair is, there's a post-it on the wall that said, don't interrupt.
Yeah.
And over time, I learned to not interrupt the client.
Wow. Wow. That's a good story. Now, not very many supervisors are probably as skilled and disciplined in using video feedback as you had the good luck to stumble into with some of the people that you chose to work with as supervisors. And in the book, you cite a statistic that's fairly shocking because there's been research that's looked at the effectiveness of supervision, and you report that only 0.1% accounts for the variance. I don't know if I'm saying that quite right.
Yeah. So that was from a study we did at a large mental health facility in Canada, where we looked at the outcomes of the clients as aggregated by supervisors. And we found that supervisors accounted for, it was actually less than 0.1% of the variance in client outcome, which was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
If the clients are having an impact, you'd expect to see more variance. Now, other studies have shown a bit more. The data is mixed. But something we can say for sure is we should not take for granted that supervision is helping client outcome. Supervision reliably helps therapists feel more confident, lower their anxiety, feel more of a professional role, right? But whether it impacts client outcome is still a subject of quite a bit of debate.
Mm-hmm. So that's fairly startling since so much emphasis is placed on supervision in training. And it may not be having much of an impact on that 50% of non-responders.
So that's what I found is my kind of traditional supervision would help me with clients that were already responding well. But typically didn't help me with clients that were not responding. And for that, I needed someone to watch videos. I needed someone to point out very specific, discrete skills. Mm-hmm. So for example, have a better working alliance is not a discrete skill. You know, that's like 100 skills under one umbrella. Mm-hmm. A discrete skill would be don't interrupt the client.
Mm-hmm.
I did a supervision with, I was in a supervision group with Victor Yalom, where he noticed that my voice sounded kind of forced, like I was trying to be an empathetic therapist rather than just being a natural person. Mm-hmm. And so he ran me through a role play where he was like, just try to talk normally. And it was surprisingly hard. He was like, pretend I'm just a friend, or try to talk normally. Uh-huh. And then what I did is I went back to my office and I watched hour after hour of my own session videos with my clients. And I just talked to the video in a normal voice. Whatever we were talking about in the video, I would repeat it, but in a normal voice. And so I'm moving that skill into procedural memory.
And so a lot of us unconsciously adapt a persona of what we think a therapist should look and sound like.
Yeah.
And the client often will detect that, you're not really being authentic with me here.
I had a client just last week tell me that. After all this work, this is an ongoing struggle. What I've found is so many of the psychotherapy skills, I almost have to relearn them to some degree with each new client. Mm. The work is so subtle. Our work is no less complicated or subtle than any kind of music or any sport or medicine or anything. And this is why I just have to continue doing my own deliberate practice to just, you know, continue improving skills for every new client.
Yeah. You point out in the book, though, that there is kind of a major obstacle to that, which is willpower, the ability to stick to this practice.
Yeah. So deliberate practice, they call it a short-term effort for long-term gain. Unfortunately, we're not recognized for doing it. We're not rewarded for doing it, compensated. Our clients don't know we're doing it. The Board of Licensure doesn't give us extra credit for doing it. And so it really requires inherent motivation. And some days
which you have in spades.
Well, not every day. I mean, right? Some days I don't. The other issue is our culture doesn't encourage it. If you were, you know, learning music or a sport, it would just be assumed everyone is going to spend a few hours a day practicing at the professional level, right? I have a friend who's in the Washington, D.C. Symphony, and she spends a few hours a day practicing 6 days a week.
Wow.
She's at the top of her, you know, she don't get any higher than that.
Yeah.
She still practices. She says if she goes a day without practicing, she can tell the difference. If she goes 2 days, her peers can tell the difference, and 3 days, her audience can.
Wow. Amazing.
So this is, I have a reminder that pops up every day that says, how good do you want to be in 5 years?
Hmm.
And when I really want to be better, I practice that day.
Okay. So you have to do a little bit of psychic jujitsu on yourself to kind of get yourself to keep doing this.
Every time.
And I got an inspiration reading your book that, you know how in the American Psychological Association and maybe other professional associations have a diplomate status, kind of really high level. If you pass your diplomate exams, then you're supposed to, that's like your black belt in psychology.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that maybe down the line, there should be some kind of an organization that would, that all the members would have to have done what you've been doing and logged a certain amount of demonstrable deliberate practice.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. It makes me think of the Board of Licensure. So when you submit your packet to become a psychologist, they want to know how many hours of time you've had with clients, right?
Yeah.
Face-to-face, and that's really important, right? We want to make sure people who are licensed have a lot of exposure to real clients. However, they don't ask how many hours you've been practicing skills. They assume that comes from the hours with clients. And in that would not apply in almost any other field.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happens is we grant people licenses when they don't necessarily, they achieve a level of competence. I think most of us are very competent by the time we have a license as a field. But we often have these kind of nagging insecurities that we're competent, but we're not necessarily good.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this would be hopefully a way to improve that.
Yeah. One of the things that you emphasized was working on skills, coming up with sort of practice tasks that are just at the edge of what you're able to, just beyond the edge of what you can do. That brought to mind learning theory and the idea of successive approximations rather than trying to get to the goal right away.
Yeah. Yeah. In psychotherapy, we all so often are trying to, you know, get to this grand goal right away, when really it's just many, many, many incremental skills. And that's what we try to focus on. In fact, I've found I supervise other therapists, and it's very challenging as a supervisor to identify very discrete skills. I was working with a supervisee yesterday, and we were working through different deliberate practice skills. And I see part of my job as a supervisor is actually to assign her homework, and the bulk of her learning will be on her own, practicing with her own videos. And we were going through different skills, and finally we got to a skill where she said, okay, that is discrete enough. She said, the other ones you were giving me were too large.
Uh-huh. So maybe another book for you down the line will be some kind of a taxonomy of discrete skills? Because I don't think we have anything like that right now.
We don't, unfortunately. And what I'm actually hoping is that the developer of all the major psychotherapy models, the developers of EMDR or ACT or EFT or that kind of thing, they will break their models down into, hundreds of discrete skills.
Wow.
And then they can each write a book on how to practice this model. Because right now we're really good at learning theory, right? Like I can write a great paper about psychotherapy and the paper can make it look like I'm a pretty good therapist.
Uh-huh.
But when you look at the video, you'll see me making mistakes left and right. It's quite different.
Yes, right. Quite a gap there. I thought that John Fredrickson's book, the one that I read and interviewed him about, the title of which I'm not remembering.
Creating Change.
Yeah, and that came the closest to what we're talking about because he really was breaking it down, with specific snippets of dialogue, kind of saying, here's how you deal with that. And I was so impressed by that because I went through my training years and years ago, and there was none of it was psychodynamic, and it was very global. We read all of these, books about theory and intricacies of theory, but there was really nothing in what was written or even in supervision that really got down to that level of, okay, here's what you do when.
Yeah, a lot of my psychodynamic colleagues are skeptical. When I say I'm using deliberate practice for psychotherapy, they assume I'm talking about some form of CBT. And I've actually found that, so John was originally trained as a classical musician, so he knew about deliberate practice from that,
mm-hmm.
and he's brought it to psychotherapy. And I've found that deliberate practice is actually most helpful with the more subtle, intersubjective aspects of dynamic therapy. And I'll give you an example.
Good.
So one of the major things to attend to when you're doing dynamic therapy is transference and counter-transference, right?
Yeah.
And this is also very challenging for many of us, particularly when we have clients that, evoke our own material conscious and unconscious. And I kept finding there are certain clients that I would enact unconscious roles with them. And John would point this out in session, where I would end up trying to push them into change. Or he even noticed once I was being critical of someone, I had my words weren't critical, but my tone of voice was. And I was quite horrified when I saw the video of that. And he said, you're now in the role of the critical parent, and the client is in the role of the disobedient child. And so he assigned me a homework assignment where I watched videos of this client, so our videos of our therapy together. And as I watched the video, I would just sit and notice, is my own anxiety going up or down? And anytime I noticed my anxiety go up, I would write down, what do I feel pulled to do with a client? Like, do I feel pulled to push them or convince them or criticize them in any way or anything like that? Basically, attending to my unconscious role moment to moment while watching the video. And after doing hours of that with my own videos, when I sat with the actual client, I was more able to do that in the background because it was more in procedural memory.
Again, I have to praise you for your commitment and willingness to stick through it, because to me it's reminding me of I went to a gym for a while to slim down or get in shape or whatever, and they were using an approach where you were supposed to go. I forgot to get rid of my phone. There'll be some ringing in the background. It will go away, everyone. Okay.
Sure.
I always get rid of the phone. The idea was that you stress yourself that till the point that your muscles fail.
Yeah.
That's a very unpleasant experience. And
yeah.
I found my enthusiasm for going back to the gym was getting less and less as time went by. I mean, to get to this point, it's not a pleasant thing.
So they've by through researching deliberate practice in all these other fields, they found one of the universal characteristics is that deliberate practice is not pleasant. No one enjoys it. In fact, if you enjoy what you're doing, it's almost by definition not deliberate practice.
Wow.
You're just rehearsing certain skills. Now, you can rehearse skills all day, which is great, but if unless you reach a point of strain, you're not pushing your capacity.
Now, I can see why I didn't get further with my music. So where the I wasn't practicing enough or hard enough.
It's tough. I mean, it's tough to get better. You think about like driving, right? So most of us, we have to strain a bit to learn how to drive.
Yeah, initially.
But once we get to a point of competence, we have our driver's license, we basically stay at the same skill level of driving for years, right? We're not really improving. Even though we could be driving every day, we're rehearsing the basic skills, but we only get better when we strain. Now, if you had a driving instructor sit next to you for 10 hours, you'd probably get better. Mm-hmm. And then you plateau again. Mm-hmm. Now, notably, getting feedback itself is not enough. I get a fair amount of feedback on my driving from my wife, and she sits next to me.
Yes. And
she notices all kinds of mistakes I make.
Me too.
And in fact, she'll repetitively notice mistakes I'm making again and again.
Yeah.
And yet I don't get better. It's because I'm not practicing. I'm not straining to address those mistakes.
So how do we as a field, I mean, that I get discouraged thinking, you know, here I'm advocating that we have an association for people who've done this. And yet it seems like such a steep climb.
So the way I think of it is, you know, many other fields took decades or centuries to develop their own methods of practice. Mm-hmm. And over that time, it got integrated into the culture. And it's just assumed now, if you're going to learn an instrument, you're going to practice. If you're going to learn a sport, if you're going to learn chess, if you're going to become a pilot, it's just part of the culture. And also the culture supports it. You know, the time is built into your schedule to do that. You're recognized for it. You're rewarded for it. If we start doing that as a culture, I think it can be very accessible. Just doing it as an N of one, it is more of an uphill battle. What I'm hoping is that over the next decade or two, we can experiment with just doing this more, and then gradually it can be integrated into our pedagogy. So it's just a standard part of the culture that everyone does.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you've got a section in the book on, exercises for specific models. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I would actually start backwards one step, which is when I started doing deliberate practice, I actually focused on more universal skills.
Such as?
So you could think of them as the common factors of psychotherapy. Some people will be familiar with that. Bruce Wampold has written a lot about that. Scott Miller has. These are the components of therapy that are important to the success across all models.
Okay.
So, for example, having a good working alliance, right?
Yeah.
Patricia Coughlin, in her recent book, talks a lot about the common factors that are important for success, right? And so I focused on those. Then, over time, I also started incorporating more specific methods from specific models. So, for example, John Fredrickson provides supervision in intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. It's a form of short-term psychotherapy, where we have certain techniques that we'll use at certain times. For example, we have a way of assessing the client's anxiety moment to moment during the session. So not just giving a diagnosis, a DSM diagnosis, but just moment to moment assessing through the client's verbal and nonverbal communication where their anxiety is. And so I would sit with a video of my clients, particularly clients with prominent anxiety. And I would just write down, sometimes I would turn the volume off, and I would just write down what body language am I seeing and what does that indicate about their anxiety. So there's one client I noticed would occasionally just kind of drift off. And I would be talking in the session. So of course, I wasn't like noticing in the session, I was saying something sure was tremendously
profound.
Right. And I noticed in the video, though, with the sound off, I was able to see that. And when I checked in with a client, it turned out they were disassociating. They're having little disassociative moments there. Mm-hmm. And then they'd pull it together. And they disassociated for a lot of their life. So they were able to basically go through life while disassociating. But it turns out that's why therapy wasn't helping, because they were disassociating while I was delivering my profound comments. And so I was able to address that, but only because I practiced it alone with videos.
Okay. That's a great example. Can you think of another one for a different therapeutic model? Put you on the spot here.
Yeah. So I could think, so I learned EMDR. I think EMDR is a great model. And
EMDR. Okay.
EMDR.
Movement desensitization.
Reprocessing.
Reprocessing.
Yeah. So I remember when I was studying that, they had a method for telling whether the eyes were going up or down was indicating different things about the client's processing. Hmm. And I forget exactly what it was, but given that, you'd want to ask clients different questions. And that's an example of something that is real easy to lose track of in session while you're, you know, doing all the other things. We're always tracking like 10 different things in therapy, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something you could practice just by watching your own videos repetitively. And just so you move that skill into procedural memory, so it's happening automatically, even while you're dealing with everything else.
Okay.
I could think for motivational interviewing. You know, I'm not an expert in these models, but in motivational interviewing, they talk a lot about the client's, I forget the exact word they use it, but will for change, right? Like how much is a client on board, right? They talk about the stages of motivation, right? And you could watch a whole video and just notice what are the signals, verbal or nonverbal, about the client's level of motivation and try to tune everything else out. This is something you can't do during a regular therapy session, is you can't just tune everything else out, but you can while studying your own videos.
Okay. So what is your advice to people who are currently in supervision?
So I have a few pieces of advice, and it differs for what stage they're at. Maybe we could start with trainees. So with trainees, I would say, actually, first of all, it's okay to just mostly focus on getting on graduating and getting your license. So the last thing we want to do is add any, you know, stress to your life. Huh. Right? Graduate school is quite stressful already, right?
Yeah.
If you find that you have extra time, energy, or money for this kind of thing, and those are big ifs, I would suggest looking for someone to teach you discrete skills using videos of your work. And it might not be your supervisor. Your supervisor's prime job is to make sure you're delivering competent services. Now, that's very important, but it's different than teaching discrete skills, mm-hmm. right? They have to check your notes and everything like that. So look for what I would call a skills coach, someone you can form a long-term relationship with, that'll look at your videos and give you very incremental feedback and help you develop exercises to practice those skills. Now, for someone in after they're licensed in, let's say, mid, later career, what I would recommend is a few things. First of all, try to videotape your work. I know it's tough to do it first. A lot of us feel really nervous about it. We think it might, you know, like might put off the clients, particularly my psychodynamic colleagues get worried about that. There's been a fair amount of research. Mark Hilsenroth, who's actually a psychodynamic researcher, recently did a study on this. And they found that clients generally didn't mind being videotaped. But when the therapist didn't like it, then the client didn't like it. Uh-huh. So therapists are more concerned about it. So watch videos of your own work. For some of your continuing education, try to get someone's feedback on your videos. It's particularly clients that are not really improving or even deteriorating.
Yeah.
If you can allocate some of your CE time for that process, and hopefully at some point we'll be given CE credit for that, that can be very effective for improving skills. And not just that, let me just add, it can be very effective for improving morale. when we feel like we're getting better, we get energy, we get more job satisfaction, we just feel better about work.
Yeah, yeah. A technical question is, how do you do video when you're doing therapy? I see a bookshelf behind you there. Is there some like very subtle little camera, or is there a huge tripod with a big honking camera?
So there's a few methods. I have a appendix in my book with some advice on this. But what I use is a pair of webcams. There's one points at the client and one points at me. Mm. And they go into a program on my computer called Wirecast that then forms a video. And let me show you here. The video is saved to this drive. This is a self-encrypting portable drive. Hmm. These are about $150 or so. And if I ever lose this or it's stolen, there's no issue because it's self-encrypting.
Oh, what a great idea.
Yeah. So that works. Another thing people do is they just use a regular video camera. If you do that, just make sure to keep it locked, you know, with your client notes. I recommend not using a cell phone or iPad or anything like that, unless it's only for that purpose. Because if you're using your home one, it's just too easy to accidentally upload the videos to the cloud and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Okay. And how about your advice to supervisors?
So, you know, I've actually found that doing deliberate practice as a supervisor is more tricky than doing it as the learner.
Wow.
And part of the issues is we learn psychotherapy more as a philosophy, like reading books and writing papers, than as a skill. And so just naturally, that's how we teach it. What I recommend for supervisors is as you're supervising, first of all, try to encourage your supervisees to videotape their work so you can see what they're doing. Second of all, try to isolate incremental skills within your model and then teach the trainee exercises to repeat those skills. Now, as a rule of thumb, if you don't get to the point where the trainee is bored repeating the skill, you haven't repeated it enough. This is a more challenging method of supervision. It's a lot easier for me to sit with my supervisee and talk about my wisdom and, you know, and they can sit there and just kind of receive my wisdom. It's a lot harder for us to sit there together and repeat skill after skill after skill.
That makes me think that there is a need for a video demonstrating that sort of work, you know, by yourself, by John Fredrickson, by Patricia Coughlin, so that people out there, so that supervisors would see that kind of supervision happening and get some inspiration about how it could be done.
Yeah, we're actually talking with Victor Yalom about making that actual video. So, you're on the money there.
Oh, good.
yeah. So, but I'm also hoping that, you know, as more supervisors experiment with doing this, we can just kind of, you know, videotape our own work and share it among each other and kind of learn it, you know, kind of as a grassroots community together. You know, that's how musicians learn to do deliberate practice, is they just experimented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know there are self-supervision groups of therapists that get together to share cases and get feedback from their colleagues, and this could become an element of that.
Yeah, exactly. So I do that with my peers. We'll share videos, we'll watch each other's videos, and give comments and look for. However, when my peers are giving me comments like, oh, Tony, you missed that or you missed this, what I'm looking for is what are the specific skills that I'm missing that I can pick up? So let me give an example. The other day, a colleague was watching a video of mine and noticed that I just kept talking about what the client was doing wrong. Like I kept talking about their, in psychodynamic language, their defenses. And he's like, you know, maybe this is why the client isn't improving. you're basically kind of getting down on him. I wasn't meaning to at all. And he's like, and what you're saying is helpful in a sense, but you know, maybe try mixing in some more kind of what's the solution? What are we aiming for, right? And asking the client to reflect more on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I watched videos with this client, and I practiced just saying to the video, just talking to the client's strengths, the client's goals, what the client's will, and helping the client do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there are any last words that you'd like to share with us.
I would just really encourage people to practice, experiment with practicing themselves. You know, I say at the beginning of the book, I'm not a master therapist. I'm not even yet an expert therapist. This is something for, this is the great leveler in a way, yeah, right? Yeah. And I'm hoping that there will be hundreds, hopefully thousands of therapists that say, I want to try this. I want to try experimenting with this. And that we can all communicate with me, that we can communicate together, and that we can share what works, what doesn't. And so kind of as a community, learn new methods for learning.
Well, Tony, I'm loving this interview because it has so much specificity in it. It's about specificity, and I don't remember another interview where it's been quite as specific as this one has been. So I'm feeling great about it, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you, Dr. David. It's such an honor to be here, and yeah, thank you again for having me.
As I'm sure you realize from having listened to the interview, I'm very excited about Dr. Rumanier's book and our conversation. I think I'll need to add this one to my best of collection on Shrink Wrap Radio's website. I think a big part of why his work makes me so excited is the total lack of this sort of specificity in my own graduate training experience. I really get the sense that the field of psychotherapy is advancing, that we're moving beyond the scattershot of competing theoretical models into an era of increasing understanding of what works in effective psychotherapy. I have to say, I'm impressed by the work of not only Tony, but all those others he cites in his book who've done the hard work of carrying out detailed research to tease out the key factors. I get the sense that the field really is advancing. I've already written my column for our upcoming January 2016 newsletter. As you heard, it's devoted to my reflections on Tony's work. If you're not already subscribed to our newsletter, go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and you'll see the sign-up form in the upper left-hand corner of the homepage. As always, you can order Tony Rumanier's book, Deliberate Practice for Psychotherapists, A Guide to Improving Clinical Effectiveness, using the Amazon affiliate widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Morgan Adolfsen from Norway, clinical psychologist. I've been a long-time listener to both Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Today, I'm so happy that I pressed the donate button. So from this day, I will regularly contribute to support your shows. And I really appreciate your work, Dave. So good luck. Thank you.
Morgan Adolfsen, thanks so much for encouraging others to follow your excellent example. I really appreciate your continuing support more than I can say. So if you're not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll respond to Morgan's passionate call to action and join him as a regular donor. In fact, I'm happy to announce three new donors, Kathy Jenner, Donna Raymond, and Luis Ramirez Gamboa. Let me mention again that we're coming into the gift-giving time of year. As a matter of fact, we're just 4 days from Christmas as I record this. If you end up buying gifts on Amazon.com, the Everything Store, please remember to use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. You can use that widget to shop for more than just books. Using it, you can navigate to any section of the Amazon site, and your purchases will be tagged as coming from Shrinkwrap Radio. It's just another way that you can help to support the show. As I've mentioned in the past, we do have a Shrinkwrap Radio app. It allows you to stream or download Shrinkwrap Radio episodes on your smartphone, whether it be an iPhone or an Android phone. It also gives you access to almost 400 of the most recent episodes. Amazing! All this content in your pocket or purse. Go to the Apps tab at Shrinkwrap Radio for full details. And as I've mentioned in the past, there have been some changes at the Zur Institute, and I've not been able to offer any new CE courses for some time. But of course, my courses that are there are timeless. So please remember, you can get 10% off on all the APA continuing education materials at the Zur Institute. Not just the courses based on my interviews. You can click on that banner in our left-hand sidebar, or simply go to zurinstitute.com. Zur is spelled Z-U-R or Z-U-R. Search through their extensive catalog and then use my discount code at checkout, which is DrDave88. That's DrDave88. Hey, if you're a health and wellness provider, such as a yoga therapist, naturopath, acupuncturist, life coach, chiropractor, midwife, or any other of a host of health and wellness providers, then it's a pretty safe bet that one of your top priorities is going to be growing your practice. That's where Swellbee.com comes in. They have created a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to list their services. When you add your business profile to their online site, new clients will be able to find you, as well as book and pay for services through this HIPAA-compliant site. It's simple and easy to use. It's Swellbee.com. And right now, you can sign up to use the service for free.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Ruminier, author of the 2017 book, Deliberate Practice for Psychotherapists, A Guide to Improving Clinical Effectiveness. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Tony Ruminier, whom we just heard from. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community, and this one comes from Mayar in Tehran, and he writes with a guest recommendation. He says, I wanted to ask if you've seen this thoughtful and sometimes funny work, Tea with Winnicott, the Interviews with Icons by Brett Carr. And he gives a link to it, and he says, I'm currently reading the book, and I guess it would make for a nice interview. Mr. Carr is a British psychologist and psychoanalyst with a number of publications, which you could check on Amazon. Regards, Mayar. Well, as always, thank you, Mayar. I'll take your recommendation into consideration and add it to my long and ever-growing list of listener suggestions. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to Dr. Tony Ruminier for teaching us all about deliberate practice for psychotherapists. Because of family visiting for the Christmas holiday, I'm going to finally take a week off and give myself some breathing room. I hope you enjoy the break as well. And if you're really hurting for an interview, I'm sure you can find one in our 536 past shows. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.